This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's the holiday season, the season of giving, and it seems Congress might be getting into that giving mood.
Well, there's give and take going on, that's for sure. Looks like both sides of the fiscal cliff negotiations are giving some serious thought to raising tax revenues on the top 2% of wage earners in this country, something that the GOP had been adamantly opposed to before now.
There seems to be some room being made for tax revenue increases in exchange for what could be some cuts to entitlement programs, but at least both sides of the aisle are showing more of a willingness to negotiate.
And Congress has until the first of the year to reach some kind of formal compromise on the budget before we fall off the fiscal cliff. And that's when a number of tax breaks for all Americans come to an end. And funding for many programs, including Medicare and Social Security, are set to see a significant drop in funding as well. And that will not make for a merry holiday season for some people.
And I have a feeling that Congress will try to get its business done before all of those are upon us. And most economists, though, warn there will be dire consequences, though, if they don't reach a settlement before the end of the year, which is up to now seems like a real likelihood.
And in fact, our guest today is very concerned about how those negotiations can affect research at the national level. As the head of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Francis Collins relies almost entirely on government funds to keep literally thousands of medical research programs going on around the country.
You're absolutely right. The National Institute of Health is the largest medical research organization in the world and is responsible for many breakthroughs in science and medicine, as well as generating about 7 million jobs in the country.
Dr. Collins also led the team that first mapped the human genome, and that single extraordinary achievement is poised to have a profound effect on what medicine looks like in the future. Actually, already is having an impact. So really looking forward to that conversation, Mark.
And we have another visit with Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
Misfacts are the gift that keep on giving. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
And we will get to our interview with Dr. Collins in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Medicaid expansion and the Affordable Care Act. The governors have had their marching orders delivered. Part of the rollout of the healthcare law includes a provision that each state must expand its Medicaid eligibility to 138% of the national poverty level, or $32,000, for a family of four. The move would make several million more Americans eligible for coverage under Medicaid. But the Supreme Court ruled this summer that states can't be required to expand. The federal government will cover 100% of that expansion for the first 3 years, followed by a slow rollback to 90% within 10 years. A number of states have flat out rejected the move, but now some states are coming around, saying perhaps they'll do a partial Medicaid expansion. The Obama administration responded this week by saying they would not qualify for federal coverage with only a partial expansion of Medicaid. 9 states, including Texas and Florida, have said they will not expand. 17 states have said they will, and the rest are still undecided. And there is a roughly similar split on states setting up insurance exchanges, the online marketplaces being set up for uninsured Americans to purchase health insurance. So far, 18 states have said they will set up federal exchanges, 6 have said they will partner with the federal government, and the rest are undecided or defaulting to the federal insurance exchange. Meanwhile, as the end of the year draws nearer, talks to avert a fiscal cliff continue, largely behind closed doors. A private meeting at the White House over the weekend between President Obama and John Boehner did not end with overt open rancor. There's growing consensus on both sides of the aisle. There will be some revenue increase on the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Wealthy, healthy, and wise. How does America's health stack up? Well, the short answer, we're living longer, but sicker, with more chronic disease. 27% of Americans are obese, 28% lead sedentary lives, and smoking rates are highest in southern states like Mississippi and Louisiana. There is some good news, though, on the childhood obesity front. Rates are showing a slight decline in certain targeted areas. New York City has reported a 5% drop in childhood obesity with a program deployed in a number of preschools and elementary schools. Rates are also dropping in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and Anchorage, Alaska. While the numbers are small, it does suggest a reversal of a 30-year trend. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're We're speaking today with Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institute of Health, which is the world's largest supporter of biomedical research. Dr. Collins is a physician geneticist who led the Human Genome Project, which achieved its goal of mapping the human genome in 2003, and is author of The Language of Life, DNA, and the Revolution of Personalized Medicine. Dr. Collins is an elected member of the Institute of Medicine and the National Academy of Science. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2007 and received the National Medal of Science in 2009. Dr. Collins, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mark and Margaret.
Well, the National Institute of Health is responsible for so much, including thousands of research studies pertaining to medicine and health. And the mission of NIH is to seek knowledge about the nature and behavior of living systems and applying that knowledge to enhance health, lengthen life, and reduce the burdens of illness. So can you share with our listeners some of the broader aspects of health in America, and what are the really important health issues that need to be addressed?
Well, first, let's point out that we have made a lot of progress when you look over the last century, the ways in which medical research has taught us about what are the causes of illness and what we could do about it. We've come a long way. Human longevity in the United States has been increasing about 1 year every 6 years for the last 30 or 40 years. It now stands at age 79. And you can look at certain causes of serious illness or premature death that are actually diminishing quite significantly. It happens slowly enough, maybe people don't notice, but heart attack deaths are down by 60% of where they were 40 years ago. Death from stroke, down by 70%. HIV/AIDS, which used to be a death sentence, now associated almost with a normal lifespan. And even cancer, which we still have a lot of work to do on, is dropping in its cause of death about 1% every year, which is progress. What are the big challenges now? Gosh, it's a very long list, but certainly areas of particular need and scientific excitement would include cancer, Alzheimer's disease, obesity and diabetes, big threat, of course, to our nation because of the epidemic we are encountering here of that condition and all of its consequences. HIV/AIDS, we have the chance to actually end that epidemic, which is a bold thing to say, but I think we could see a path forward to that. Or something like autism, which is frustrating and growing in its frequency and need to understand it and come up with better interventions. So our plate is very full at the National Institutes of Health. We have programs in all of those disorders and many others trying to find answers.
Well, Dr. Collins, I really appreciate your leading with that good news and optimism. And I do think people don't realize the progress we've made in reducing deaths from heart disease and so many other things, as you've said. And you personally have had the opportunity to lead in one of the most transformative breakthroughs of the modern medical era, the complete mapping of the human genome. It took 13 years and $4 billion, which your team did in 2003. And just 10 years later, we've gotten the technology down to where a person could choose to have their entire genome sequenced in a day for maybe $1,000. So here we are on the threshold of the ultimate tool for clinicians, I think, who seek to provide true personalized medicine. Tell us about the promises and the challenges and maybe the limitations too of genomics in transforming the way healthcare is practiced in the not too distant future.
Well, the genome is the instruction book for human biology. It's that wonderful information molecule called DNA with all of the letters that make up each of our instruction books. About 3 billion of them, in fact, is the human genome. And mine and yours are about 99.5% identical. By having not only sequenced that first reference genome, but now having a huge amount of information about differences and how they associate with disease risk and a lot more about how the genome actually functions, we really are in a position to be able to do some pretty interesting things. And one area is the ability to use information about your DNA along with your family history to predict what you're at risk for in the future and to give people a chance to practice more individualized preventive medicine instead of one size fits all. I think another area where genomics is already having an impact is the ability to predict for an individual who has a particular disorder where treatment is needed, what's the right drug and what's the right dose for that person. And a lot of that is determined by differences in DNA, and we can measure those and make better predictions. We call that pharmacogenomics, which is a lot of syllables, but I think you get what that's about. And there's now more than a dozen drugs for which it's recommended that, if possible, you have that kind of analysis before the drug choice is made. Maybe, though, the place where genomics is furthest along in terms of its impact on health is cancer. cancer is a disease of the genome. It comes about because of misspellings in a gene somewhere that causes cells to grow when they should have stopped. But every cancer is different. That's what we're learning. And so the one-size-fits-all approach to breast cancer or prostate cancer doesn't look like it's the right answer now either. If we could actually identify for each individual what's driving their cancer and then pick from the list of more targeted drug therapies what's the right mix for that person, we'd probably be on the path towards much better outcomes and less toxicities.
Dr. Collins, I really love your simple description of that we have the instruction book. What are the challenges and the opportunities again? And I want to go back there. Is there anything where we're on the precipice of a revolution in the way that we treat certain disorders? And also, is there some concern that once people think we have the instruction book, that we will get to these answers right away?
Well, we do have to be careful not to oversimplify or imply that answers are immediately at hand. The genome is an incredibly complicated instruction book, and we're still learning how to read it. And certainly, although I've talked about cancer a minute ago, in terms of our ability to do individualized diagnosis of what's driving a particular tumor, we still have way too short a list of interventions available. We have to work very hard in what you'd call translational science to take the discoveries about what it is that causes cancer and connect those up. We're there on a few instances, and we all can tell dramatic stories of people who had far advanced cancer where everything seemed to have failed, and then the cancer got analyzed, and they had an Achilles heel sort of finding that, oh my gosh, if you just tried that drug, which you never would have thought of for that tumor, and maybe you'll get a response, and people suddenly find, wow, the tumor's melting away. 6 months later, the person's back at work. We all have stories like that, but we need more of them. I guess another area where the whole idea of genomics is starting to play a big role in is to try to figure out what's going on with children with birth defects or other kinds of unexplained difficulties in childhood. And once in a while, you have a dramatic result. I'll tell you one about a pair of twins from Texas who had their DNA sequenced to try to find out why these twins were having this progressive neurologic disease that seemed to be threatening to shorten both of their lives fairly dramatically by the time they were teenagers. And what was discovered was a glitch that was immediately clear what was going on. They were missing an enzyme that was necessary for their bodies to make a particular neurotransmitter that could be supplemented actually in their diet. And they are both now remarkably vibrant, healthy young people, which is pretty amazing from a kid who was considered unlikely to make it to her 18th birthday.
You know, Dr. Collins, you talk about there being five T's to medical research, and that includes the technology, talent, threat, and telling stories. And I think
You just told a story
that will permanently stick with me because it's a very compelling story, which is why they're so important.
Yes.
Tell me about the transition. Is this really about how we get the knowledge of what was accomplished in that specific instance into practice and disseminated throughout the healthcare community? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how that works on a policy level at the NIH as well.
Sure. So translation generally means taking the basic science discoveries about how life works and how disease occurs, which are pouring out of the laboratories that NIH supports, and making sure that those don't just sit there, but they actually get moved into new ideas about diagnosis and devices and therapeutics and actually provide benefit to patients in the clinic as quickly as possible, because that can be a very long, slow process and the failure rate can be very high. That means trying to identify what the bottlenecks are, and they occur all the way along, depending on which technology you're trying to move forward.
We're speaking today with Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institute of Health, which is the world's largest supporter of biomedical research. Dr. Collins is a physician geneticist who led the Human Genome Project. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom and received the National Medal of Science for his groundbreaking work in genomics. You know, Dr. Collins, I want to pull the thread a little the conversation you were just having about the value proposition that NIH provides for our country, and look a little behind the scenes at the business paradigm that supports the research. And it is, walk us through a little bit about the struggle that NIH is always facing, but perhaps now more than ever.
Yeah, it is now more than ever, and I think we all understand why that is, given the fiscal stresses our nation is facing with a ballooning deficit and the need to do something about that. Yet at the same time, if you were looking for a way to dig the economy out of the difficulties it's in, you'd probably want to search for investments that are known to have a return. And in that regard, when you look at biomedical research, as many have now done, this is not only the best investment for advancing human health, it's also one of the very best investments you can make in the economy. People have looked at that and have come up with some pretty staggering numbers. The NIH supports directly about 488,000 jobs, but when you consider all the ways in which that supports what goes on in small businesses, biotech, and pharmaceutical industry, we're probably talking more like 7 million jobs that are directly related to what NIH puts their funding into. And on top of that, people have done the calculations on return on investment, and it's clear that every dollar spent on biomedical research returns more than twofold in just 1 year in terms of the local economy, and 85% of our dollars go out to grants to our nation's finest universities in all of the 50 states. So that's where the economic benefit occurs. I'll give you one startling example of how the return can occur. You mentioned the Genome Project a little bit ago, and that's something I'm fairly proud of in terms of how it turned out. But somebody recently looked to say, of that $4 billion that was spent over 13 years, what have we gotten so far as economic return? And they calculated, like a year ago, that it already added up to $796 billion in just the U.S. So even accounting for inflation, that came to 141-to-1 return on investment. It is serious right now in terms of how those decisions play out, particularly in terms of one of those five T's you mentioned, which is talent. Mm-hmm. I'm particularly worried about young scientists who are just getting started, who are full of ideas and creativity at a time where science has never had more potential mm-hmm. than right now. And yet their chances of getting supported by NIH are at historically low levels and could plummet to almost unimaginably low levels, which would make it very difficult for many of those young scientists to keep going.
Dr. Collins, it's always my sense it's one of the not as well known as it should be treasures of the United States. How the research agenda is set for NIH and the leadership of NIH in setting the research agenda is important to all of us across the country. So perhaps you could share a little bit of your thoughts with us on that.
It's a very much an ongoing discussion that we have almost every day around here. About half of NIH research dollars go into basic science, which is not targeted towards developing a direct advance in medicine, and the other half is focused on translation or on clinical research where there really is that intention, and our mission encompasses both of those activities. But factored into that is public health need. So we pay attention to what are the disorders that are causing the greatest amount of morbidity and mortality and where are the scientific opportunities to make advances in those areas, and then we try to place our bets in that regard. But we can't do just that, or we would neglect rare diseases. At the same time, by studying rare diseases, we often learn things. And the whole thing is actually supported by the best peer review system in the world, where any grant that comes to NIH, that has to be reviewed by experts who look at it and say, what's the promise here? What would happen if this actually worked? What's the likelihood it's going to work? That is the main reason why NIH has been so successful over these many decades, is that we have absolute rigor in terms of how we decide what to fund.
Dr. Collins, this year NIH opened up a new division, the National Center for Advancing Translational Science. So it seems to me that you're doing from the translational research, hopefully, to the transformational breakthroughs in primary care, but then back to the transactional work that happens in the day-to-day settings in primary care or other places. So walk us through that cycle and tell us a little bit about the impact that you're having on those hospital and clinic practices.
So sure, the center you mentioned, National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS, is a new arrival on the scene, but NIH has many other investments in this space. But there are all kinds of other places along this long, complicated, failure-prone pipeline from an idea to a new therapy that's been widely accepted, where we aim to try to knock down barriers. If you'd really like to know, when you're contemplating giving a new drug to somebody for a disease that desperately needs a new treatment, is the drug going to be safe? And the way we traditionally have done that has been using small animals and large animals and hoping they would predict human toxicity. But we all know it's not that reliable. We're working with the Department of Defense, namely DARPA, their wild and crazy group of bioengineers, to try to develop biochips loaded up with human cells derived from this new stem cell technology that allows you to develop those from any individual representing liver or kidney or heart or brain, and to be able to assess in a much more realistic situation, is this drug going to be safe or toxic for that individual? This is going to revolutionize the way we both develop drugs and test for them for safety in the next 5 years. This notion that once you have developed something that looks like a good intervention, you got to be sure it works in the real world. I'm on the board of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, which is a new enterprise supported by the Affordable Care Act, which has as its main mission trying to develop research protocols to figure out what really works in the real world, and let's be sure that we're asking the patients whether they agree and not just checking to see what the measurements are in the laboratory. And that's going to be, I think, a major entry into this space of trying to provide primary care physicians with useful information that they can act upon and be confident it's going to apply in their environment.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, the world's leading supporter of biomedical research. Dr. Collins led the team that first sequenced the human genome and is the recipient of the National Medal of Science. Dr. Collins, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we recently looked at claims about the Affordable Care Act from a group called Americans for Tax Reform. The group made the claim that under the law, employers must offer preventive coverage that includes abortion, but that's not true. The law does require that insurance plans sold on state-based exchanges cover preventive care, but the states are the ones that define what that preventive coverage is. Some states already have banned abortion coverage beyond exceptions for rape, incest, or danger to the life of the mother, and 20 states have banned insurance companies from offering plans that cover abortion on these state-based exchanges. Other states will allow plans to cover voluntary elective abortion, but the law then requires those states to offer one plan on the exchanges that doesn't cover abortion. In other words, the law doesn't require plans to cover abortion. In fact, what it requires is that state-based exchanges include at least one insurance plan that doesn't. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. 1 in 6 people in the world lacks access to drinking water or basic sanitation, and statistics show that diarrhea is the leading cause of death for these populations. In Africa, the numbers are staggering, with 46% of the residents of sub-Saharan Africa having no direct access to clean water. In 2005, artist Tracy Hawkins went to Tanzania to see what she could do about it. Clay pot water filtration has been around for several hundred years, where simple clay pots lined in the bottom with silver oxide can remove up to 99% of the impurities from most water sources, but no one had undertaken a dedicated program to produce and distribute these pots. Tracy founded the Singisi Pottery Project and began making the pots with local artisans in this region of Tanzania. She and her team were able to get a factory built so that they could increase production. The project has served multiple communities and continues to expand. Independent researchers have determined the system to be safe, effective, and the best part, the health of entire communities has been improved significantly once each village resident is provided with a clay filtration system. The pots are inexpensive to produce, easy to handle, and the factory has also created created jobs for local residents. They have since changed the name of the organization to Safe Water Ceramics of East Africa, a simple, easily manufactured solution that improves access to potable water for a community, one that improves health, well-being, and economic conditions at the same time. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.